You may know John Robb as being the bassist and singer of The Membranes, member of Gold Blade. Perhaps you know the Louder Than War website, which he writes for and runs. He's authored over 20 books, so perhaps you know him because of that. His latest book is entitled The Art of Darkness, The History of Goth. Check the show notes for links and dates for his Q&As having to do with the book. In this episode, he talks about The Damned, The Stranglers, Sisters of Mercy, Living DIY, Green Populism, and more. So here you go. Longtime journalist and champion of many worthy avenues, causes, and mindsets. The busiest person I've ever met. The most excellent John Robb on Diane's Kamikaze Fun Machine. I was in Manchester. The last time I was there was for the Dan reunion shows.
Oh, I was at that. The Apollo's fantastic gig, wasn't it?
I saw you there. Yeah.
I remember. Yeah, yeah.
That was really
so long. Yeah, so you're just thinking, this is one of the greatest rock and roll bands I've ever seen.
Oh, my God.
How come they fucked it up so badly? you know, like you think in 1977, they didn't have a hit record. Everybody else had a hit record, even bands that everyone's forgotten about. The Damned didn't even get in top 75, any singles or albums. And with a band that was that good, with classic songs. And when they reformed, they sounded even better, didn't they?
I was honestly expecting kind of like, oh, dealing with members who hadn't been together in a while. And I'd heard all types of rumors about Brian James's physical condition. Dude, they sounded like the MC5. They were so heavy.
They were, weren't they? Yeah, I mean, I actually prefer the Damned. The Brian James Damned, I think they're equal to the Stooges and MC5, and probably better sometimes. Just in those early records are so exciting when you listen to them.
I bought tickets for that show as soon as they went on sale. I think it was before COVID.
Yeah, it's a long time. They have to keep kicking it back, didn't they? Maybe do some more. And I don't think they decided to stop. Because I mean, I like the Damned now, of course, but I think that lineup was something pretty unique and special. And I think I think Brian James had an amazing vision. You know, he was ahead of the game, wasn't he? You know, I think, you know, with the Damned in 76, 77, he's definitely one of the players, but he never really gets the credit, does he?
No. His EP, I think it's just called Brian James, I'm not sure, is one of my favorite records. It's just so good.
I always like that Sands the Youth single he did, you know, the thing he did after the Damned.
Yeah.
It sort of came out, we did about 10 gigs, did an appeal session, then stopped, and that was it. It's just like, give me a bit more time.
Well, it was a different time then.
Nowadays, because of the internet, you can sort of survive outside the game, you know, whereas then if music press didn't like it, you weren't getting a radio play, you were dead, you know, whereas now you can sort of create your own little space, can't you, which a lot of bands do.
So you're going to be coming to the States?
Yeah, in October, yeah. So I've got a couple of things going on in New York, then maybe Chicago, then a whole bunch of things in LA, San Francisco. So, yeah, it's going to be good. About time I got out there, did a book tour.
Have you done a book tour in the States before?
No, I haven't. I mean, I've done stuff in Germany, and I've done stuff, obviously, in the UK. Because this book keeps going and going, there's a lot more stuff. So, I mean, in the UK, I've done about 40 dates this year. Then I did a German tour in February, and it's American. But I might come back to America later in 24, just see how this one goes. Because in the UK now, there's like a circuit of things you can do with books, whereas it wasn't 20 years ago. I don't know if it's the same in America. You know, like in the UK, you could go to normal gig venues and do a book gig. You know, people know how to do them now. But when I first went to my punk book 20 years ago, that stuff didn't exist. So it's kind of changed a bit now.
Well, you should bring all your books.
I'm not sure if I can carry them.
That's a lot for carry-on, yeah.
Trying to get them couriered to each gig. I mean, this is just a practical thing, but it's such a nightmare. You know, like, I did a thing in Birmingham at a festival yesterday, and the courier didn't turn up, of course. I had to sell the books and post them to people this week, so I've got to get them couriered to Manchester. It's just like piddly bits of crap, you know. There's nothing really works. I don't know, it's like in America, but nothing really works properly in England. The trains never turn up, and the post is always shit. It's not, obviously, it's not like living in Ukraine, you know, it's not that bad, but it's little things that never join together properly.
Well, it seems like you're dealing quite well and your output is not hampered by the powers that be, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think punk rock trained us all very well, didn't it? How to survive
Yeah.
DIY and outside the system. You know, it's, I mean, all day you're just doing workarounds. You know, you kind of assume, well, that ain't going to work. I've got a plan B in the pocket. I'm ready. You know, as you know, I put companies or record labels, they don't understand all that stuff. They just give up. You know, whereas in the world I was in for, like, well, I'm still in for years. You know, if you could turn up a gig and the PA doesn't work, you fix the PA and carry on playing, don't you? Or if
Right.
the van breaks down, everyone gets on a coach. We're still going to get there and do the thing.
Right, exactly. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the book. You've been doing some of your book tours in amazing venues that can only be in England, of course, well,
Yeah,
or in Europe. Yeah, we have no castles to give you here.
there are some oldish things, aren't there? I mean, New York, that side is 300 years old, and Canada, of course, I've been to Quebec, and that's like a 17th century French city, sort of. And then that's not counting the Native Americans who've been there for 2,000 years, so I'm not sure if the book will go down well in those kind of spaces. Yeah, so I mean, in England, there is a lot of great Gothic spaces you could do events in, like amazing looking art galleries. The one I did in Sheffield on Friday was great. It was a mausoleum in a graveyard, and it's just, you couldn't get any more perfect than that, you know. So it's had all these great overgrown gravestones, because it's been abandoned for such a long time, this place. But they kind of renovated the mausoleum and they put little gigs and clubs on in there, and it was just so perfect for this event. It was just great. So yeah, so there's been a few of those. I mean, I think with the book tour, I was up for doing any spaces. In fact, what I was trying not to do was the big bookshops, you know, the big chain shops, because they're often, ironically, the worst places to do book events in. Gig venues, festivals are good. Just, and these kind of weird sort of Gothic buildings are great, just perfect for it, you know.
So we're in this space in the world where the things that we've lived through and experienced are now considered historic, right? It's like punk is history. And obviously you've delved deeper in the music and all that than what one thinks of. Like in the goth scene, you started the book off with the Visigoths, and you also really feature architecture and so much history. How did your process work in terms of putting this together?
Yeah, I like the idea of it not just being a unique moment in time. I think it was definitely, in a way, every generation deals with blues, whether it's writing, you know, poetry or doing paintings or designing cathedrals in the 16th to 18th century. Or in my time, in the late 70s, early 80s, the, like, because music culture was the main culture, that's where you would express those feelings in, you know. So I like the idea that, you know, when Lord Byron was doing his stuff in eight, you know, 1815 to 20, he was just doing the same kind of things what Nick Cave or Bauhaus are doing now, expressing the same kind of feelings in the same kind of artful kind of way, but using the premier art forms of that period, you know, that you had access to. And I think Goth especially lends itself really well to that longer narrative. You know, there are some music cultures which will just fit into their period of time. But with Goth, you could definitely see that lineage all the way through. And maybe the Visigoths was pushing it a bit. But I like the idea of having the Visigoths in there. It's the first time anybody ever used the word Goth. So I think that makes it a good place to start. And also it kind of frames it, because it did create a dark shadow over Europe. So when the Germans did build their own architecture in the 13th century, it's sneered at by, you know, the people into classical architecture. They were sneering at the Germans, less what they thought was lesser architecture as being Gothic. That was their, like, put down term for it. And in the end, it became its own style. The Germans celebrated their own Gothic style, you know, and it went on beyond the buildings. And I thought that was actually quite a neat parallel to Gothic itself, which was not critically acclaimed when it first came out. You know, there's very few people who wrote about music who actually embraced it as a form. You know, I mean, mainly in the UK, it was John Peel, you know, the radio DJ, championing a lot of those bands and gave them a lifeline that the music papers just wouldn't.
So the topic of this book comes with its own historic section, like built in, like great photo shoots immediately. As soon as goth music comes up, it's like, oh, I know where we can take our pictures. That stuff has been standing for centuries.
Yeah, when he plays, it's interesting because he played very knowingly, plays with his own history whilst being part of his own history. And now, because it's been written about, say, in the context of my book, 45 years later, it's become its own history. So, like if you're 18, some of the names in this book will be from the dim, distant past, as much as Lord Byron is. They're all historical kind of figures, aren't they? If you're a teenager reading the book, it's all stuff that happened a long time ago. And I like that idea as well. And I think with the internet, time is just flattened into it. Just one, you don't get a future and a past anymore. Everything's there all at the same time, which is the way you would listen to music if you were younger now. The Doors or a contemporary band putting a track out this week is all at the same time, and I think that's important to remember as well, especially pop culture. Pop culture, it doesn't really date, it's kind of all there all at once, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true. I've got nieces who are in their late teens, and I'm always making CDs for them because one of them has a used car with a CD player. The one said to me the other day, like, "Oh, I like that T-Rex." They don't have any context for the fact that Mark Bolan's been dead for like 50 years.
Yeah, it just sounds like it's now. It still sounds like the now. But maybe, I suppose, if you look at the history of everything, the Earth's been here 4 billion years. So, what's 50 years out of that? So, in a way, it's quite weird growing up in pop culture my age that, say, when I was agreed to glam rock in 73, 74, 1960s seemed like 500 years before. It just seemed such a long time ago, you couldn't imagine it even existing. And that's, I think it's a very different way people think now. I think they just think it's all there all at once. It's all on Spotify. You can make a Spotify playlist out of completely random different types of music from different time zones and play them all virtually at the same time. And I think that's cool. I think it's good that music works like that. As long as if you're young, you don't get bogged down in the past. It's great to listen to the past, but it's also really important to reinterpret it for your own generation. It shouldn't just be people our age telling you what to listen to, basically. They could go, T-Rex is completely brilliant, but I also really like this, or just have their own things or their own interpretations or embrace things from the past that we thought were rubbish then, but make complete sense now. You get a lot of that. If you go to, you listen to what the students listen to, you go past the student bar, and the music, you think, wow, how the hell did that get through? Everyone hated that then. And it's somehow become a really cool track because it's in a completely different context, which I like. I think that's good. It should always be reinterpreted. No generation owns pop culture.
What was the turning point for you in the 70s? Like when you talked about the 60s at least seeming to be more homogenized, and that might have been when you were young, too young to find an underground.
Oh God, yeah, we even have no idea where the underground was in the 70s. It just When I used to read the newspapers, I remember reading newspapers in the 70s when I was like a kid, and they'd have articles on these bands like Budgie or Man, bands you probably never heard of in America. And they were bands that didn't really get the charts, to get their albums get to like number 48 or something. I thought, how do these people even live? Is this a made-up band? I didn't realise they spent their whole life in that same kind of culty zone, and you can actually survive in that space. I just thought Top of the Pops, which is a premier British music program that used to play all the hits on it, on TV show. I thought that was it. I didn't know there was other stuff outside. So I read the newspaper, thought, wow, there's actually things that don't get on Top of the Pops. I mean, don't these people just starve to death? If somebody put a record out and it got to number 11, it seemed like their career was over. I remember Mott the Hoople split up because they had about six hits and then the seventh track got to number 40 and then they just stopped the band because that's it, it's over now. Whereas now, you just take a year off and come back and start playing all your hits and just carry on forever. Whereas then it was like the death knell, one track that didn't quite catch on as much as the others. It was like an express train, really. So for me, it was glam rock, that period of glam. I'm 62 now. So when I was, 10 or 11, it was Bowie and Bolan, but all the glam. It wasn't just, I'm not one of those people who say Starman and Top of the Pops changed my life. Sweet and Slade and Mott the Hoople, Mud, even all the bands that weren't glam, they're sort of semi-glam bands or sort of glam adjacent bands. David Essex's first two albums, amazing records, stuff that wasn't cool, or stuff that was really cool, like Roxy Music. We had no idea it was cool. You're too young to get the reference points. I didn't know they went to art school, I didn't know what art school was. I'm 12. I'm living in Blackpool. You know, even though I did have an art college, but we wouldn't know about it. It was a very naive process of getting into music. You know, we couldn't filter it. You just liked what you liked. Gary Glitter, people, you know, you liked Gary Glitter. Well, obviously, you couldn't say that now, could you? But the records were great. You thought, we often thought, why is that fat old bloke pretending to be Elvis? But the record sounds good. I didn't even know that one of the main guy in the Glitter Band was actually from Blackpool, where I'm from, you know, where Rebellion is. That's where I grew up. And John Russell did all the brass parts on the Gary Glitter records. And I made some, years later, just before John died, I made some records with him. I mean, he obviously knew nothing about Gary Glitter, you know, Gary Glitter's horrible reality. I mean, how would he know? He's not going to tell him, is he? So when he was about 78, we made some Glitter Band style records, and he sounded ace. It's so good to work with somebody that style. And also, maybe shine a bit of spotlight back on him, because I felt sorry for him, because his whole life has been tainted by being in a band with a singer who had a dreadful, despicable private life. You know, John didn't, you know, and John was talented. You know, it's a producer who made the records, Mike Leander. So it's all those kind of records up here, very formative. And I think in that book, in my goth book, most of the chapters when I speak to each band separately, they were all really into glam rock as well. We were children of glam, you know. Bauhaus, Daniel Ash was a big glam fan, you know. Everybody went through that thing. Everybody who's 61, 62 nowadays, he went through that period. Glam was the thing. In a way, goth was glam with dark clothes.
Yes, just a different wardrobe. There's a quote in the book, and I'm not sure if you wrote it or if it was quoted from somebody else, but you wrote, goth was the new generation because punk rock was shoved down our throats.
Johnny Marr said that, yeah. Okay. I mean, Johnny had a good point. Yeah. I mean, Johnny likes punk, of course, you know, and he loves the Buzzcocks and stuff. But he's just making a good point about generation gaps. You know, I think it was interesting because punk thought it was the ultimate generation gap. Of course, within 2 years, you become the old guard, you know, and Johnny's younger than me. He's about, is he 59? He's a couple of years younger, 2 or 3 years younger. So he's slightly too young for punk, you know, full-on punk. When he got into his thing, music had moved on, but he had all these old guys kept going about, you know, the great old days of punk, you know, which is kind of weird, isn't it? Because it is like that now, you meet.
Yeah.
Oh, punks still talk about how punk bands are here to show young people how to make proper music. You think that's not the point of punk. I mean, it's great. I mean, I love the way Charlie Harper keeps doing UK subs. I think they sound fantastic in that, but they're just a great old school band. And Charlie would not for 1 minute would be claiming that he's here to show the 16-year-old kids how to make their music. He's just a great rock and roll trooper, still maintaining a good band. After a couple of years, punk still sounded great to listen to, but it wasn't like the cutting edge of pop culture, you know. And I think every scene has to put up with that. You get your moments in the sun, and then there's something else comes and they're the edge, you know. You're not the edge anymore. There may still be good work getting done there. You're not the defining scene that everybody has, you know, has to measure themselves up against. Unless you're someone like, I don't know, like David Bowie, and you've always been able to shape-shift the way. You've always been ahead of pop culture all the time because you're very smart. I mean, a lot of bands, they kind of stumble on one great sound and they can't find another, so they just hone that one sound down to perfection, which is cool, you know. But, you know, they're really super talented people, the ones who always stay one step ahead, which is difficult. To stay one step ahead and not make a fool of yourself is even harder.
Yeah, well, if that matters, yeah.
Yeah, that's the other thing, isn't it? Not to be bothered about making a fool of yourself. That's part of it, isn't it? You know, when you're on a stage, you're a genius and a clown. Was it Mick Jagger that said that? I can't remember. It's a pretty neat quote, isn't it? It's just you are, one level you're really cool, and the other level is completely ridiculous. But if you understand that ridiculousness, that's the key. And Bowie did, you know, that's the key thing. When he understood that, you know, the 60s rock and roll was really earnest, wasn't it? You know, it was about the truth or whatever, even though that was all pretend. And what Bowie did was he said it's kind of artifice. It's kind of, there is a fakeness to this, but you know what? The fakeness is completely brilliant. And also, you could be really emotional inside that fakeness, which is a really, really clever trick, you know. So he's playing two or three different things at once. And that was very influential on goth as well. You know, there's a lot of people in that scene understood the ridiculousness of rock and roll, but also celebrated it. Sister Mercy, a fantastic example of that. You know, Angela Eldridge, it's almost like an ironic pastiche of rock and roll cliche and a celebration of it at the same time. But also to this day, still sound, because the drum machine still sounds incredibly futuristic. In a way, pop culture has pervaded society, Western society so much that everybody lives in a pop culture kind of world now. You know, whereas in the 70s, when I grew up, the people, it's just David Bowie, you know, the pop star world did it. It seemed like they came from outer space. They made amazing music. It's like works of art. And they had mad lifestyles, and that's what they did, you know, and the rest of us didn't. Whereas now, it's a lot more blurred, isn't it? You know, you could be your own little esoteric alien pop star figure with 26 followers, you know. And you know, people run their Instagram accounts like their PR, aren't they? Like lots of pictures of themselves looking cool and stuff. I mean, everyone does that, don't they? And it's interesting because I actually speak to Alan McGee about this the other day, and he was saying it's about the image of what you look like now is more important than the music. And that plays out in golf as well. So a lot of the golf influencers now, they have like sort of pages where they have pictures of themselves up and no music. The music is not even part of it. But in a way, that's gone back to the 17th century. So instead of doing a painting, just take a picture of yourself or do a little film clip and stick it on TikTok, you know. Again, it's another generation dealing with its blues with the contemporary culture that's at hand at the time, you know. It still reflects those interesting feelings that run through goth of euphoria and melancholia.
Well, I think growing up and being in the punk scene in the late 70s, early 80s, you had to really pull everything to you. You had to find it. You had to create it yourself and create your own thing. And I guess now, it just seems overwhelming. I can't imagine being young and trying to find a path.
I think in the 70s, because it was a lot slower. But people who were from the 50s would already think that was sped up from the 50s. You know, it'd have already seemed like, oh, it's so overwhelming. There's 10 singles a week come out. How do you know which ones to like? Yeah. So culture does speed up. People move quickly with it, don't they? So maybe there's 1,000 great tracks. Just flick through them to find one that holds your attention, or 1,000 images, or 1,000 little clips of film, or loads and loads of ideas. And every now and then, one coalesces that people can hold on to. I mean, as a music writer, it's a nightmare. There's loads of music out there, and most of it's pretty good. That's the other thing. It's not like loads and loads of shit, and then it's like this little corner where all the good stuff is. Most bands are actually not that bad at what they're doing now. They're sort of a higher level. I mean, when we started in bands, we had no idea what we're doing. We couldn't play musical instruments. We didn't know what the scales or chords were. We just went hitting the guitars and made a noise, and that was our first gig, you know. And that was so naive. So you know, they're really great bands. They're all really good players, you know. When people went on about how the Sex Pistols could play, that's just rubbish. Cook and Jones and Matlock are really amazing, great musicians, you know. Sounded really good. They wrote really great songs. One of the greatest pop bands this country's ever produced. It's not just a bunch of kids getting on stage, hitting guitars, hoping something would sound good like we were. I mean, we were really DIY, but we thought that was what it was about. In a way, that was probably a bit of a myth, and we fell for it.
Everybody's got their own path. What did you want to be when you were a kid?
Oh, nothing. I didn't want a job. I never wanted a job. I was at school, we did a careers thing where they asked you 100 questions to try and work out what jobs you want. I got the lowest mark of all time. I actually got 0%. So that was a bit of a hopeless case, really. I never wanted a job, but people told me what to do. Pretty selfish, I suppose, but I managed to find my own little space. Even when I went to college, I never went to any lectures or anything. They threw me out. And then about 3 months ago, they gave me my degree 43 years later.
It all comes full circle.
Yeah, it does to me. So I've got like a honorary doctorate or something. I don't even know what it is, but it was good fun going to get it. Because it's all different now, isn't it? Because the people running the college are into the music I like, but they're about my age and that. So they just want to talk about obscure post-punk music and that, you know. So again, like you talk about initially, it's become respectable, hasn't it? It's become history, you know. That's stuff that we were doing when we were kids. Your school thing, you completely fucked your life up by being in a band. Because that's what people thought then, you know. Being in a band was the most hopeless thing you could possibly do. It's become like everybody's parents make their kids be in bands. I don't think the kids even want to be in bands. Yeah. It was quite a renegade then, wasn't it? It was an outsider culture that's come in on the inside. We've all become respectable. It's horrible, isn't it?
When did you start the book?
I'd say years ago. It was even longer now, I think. It was on and off. I'd do a bit, then I'd forget about it, do something else. But when I first came up with the idea of the book, no publisher would do a book about goth music. It was quite a battle to get anybody interested, which is ironic now because every publisher's got his own kind of version of my book out. You know, there's like lots suddenly it's like a load of history of goth books come flying out with like really big advances. When I went round, all the publishers go, it's a nice idea, but it's not the kind of thing that we'll really sell. And it, I mean, I went through about two publishers, didn't really get what I was doing. So I bought the book back and put it out myself, and then just went crazy, you know, self-release initially for about 4 months, and trying to keep on top of it while you're doing a book tour and everything else. Just mental, you know, you're trying to get a hold of books and trying to get it reprinted while you're sat in a train trying to go somewhere else. It's like being an obscure band stumbles into having a hit.
Yes, or running out of t-shirts while you're on tour.
Oh yeah, it always happens. So then always arguing your record labels, you know, we run out of CDs, and they always talk to you, go, oh, we can't have any more. You go, well, we need some more, we're only halfway through the tour. And they think it's like annoying that you want more stuff, and you always have to go, okay, I'll print them myself. Oh no, we found some. You say, don't you know what you're dealing with? You're like, in my world, we could do all this ourselves. You know, it's almost like we're doing you a favor by letting you put it out. I'm not. I think some people still think bands are like it is in the 70s when they were really naive. You know, they always used to call bands the boys, didn't they? Like, because they were like children, whatever. They yeah. like that now. Most bands know what they're doing. Young bands are really well organized. You know, they have one person books the gigs, one does the logistics, one does the social media. You know, they split their jobs up, and so much, but they have little WhatsApp groups where they discuss what they're going to be, you know, have you sorted the van out yet and all that. But when an older band gets a gig, the rest of them just sort of wait for you to go and pick them up.
It does really make it easier.
It does make it easier, doesn't it? But, you know, a lot of the older bands don't understand it. They don't understand the technology, you know. So it's kind of weird, isn't it? It's like a generation gap in rock and roll, which again, it should be, shouldn't it? You know, I started bands. I was always the one who wanted to make it work. So I'd be the one that had to stand in the phone box for hours and then ringing people up all over the world trying to find gigs and things. Whereas now the internet's so much easier, isn't it? You know, you can get the information and things. And that's good. I think that's a great thing. It's such a massive sea change in culture, isn't it? You know, if you go to a college and talk about music, and sometimes you have to go talk about your life and music, and it's when you're kind of saying you have to stand there in a phone box ringing people up, they must think you're insane. Yeah. They must think, why don't you just email everybody or make a Facebook group or something? It didn't exist. The other weird thing about the internet is it feels like it's been here for like 100 years now, doesn't it? And yet, the brother of the guy who invented the internet, the British guy who came with the idea of it, his brother is a university here who's a lecturer in green eco studies. And I spoke to him on the phone, and he's younger than me. I thought, wow, this is so weird. In my head, I just think, you know, the internet's been around so long, the person who invented it must be like Einstein or something. But no, they're actually like a year younger than me.
Wow.
The weird sort of time curve, isn't it?
I think altogether we're experiencing a time curve.
Once you speak to scientists, and I know quite a few scientists do the studying the universe things. I know a lot of guys in the CERN project, and they'll tell you there's no such thing as time. It's a human concept. We're trying to measure our reality. And if there is time anyway, if it can be proved it does exist, it curves, you know, see a plane flying above you is a billionth of a second, I think it's behind where we are on the ground and that. So like if you extrapolate that across the whole universe, the universe is so insane huge, it's billions and billions of years out, so in the same time point of time. So it's not the right measurement really. Time doesn't really measure time, that's the problem. But no one's figured out what it actually does, which is kind of interesting, isn't it? It's a frontier you can't see, isn't it? You think about the universe and the sheer scale of it and the implausibility of everything. It definitely puts everything in its place, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. And we're just microscopic and nothing.
But then I find that really inspiring. I think, you know, even though, you know, even our galaxy is nothing really compared to the whole universe. It's one of trillions of galaxies, not even a big one. But, you know, the moment you're here, in that moment, suddenly becomes even more powerful. Because even if you're, like, really, really obscure and you're only a puny little human, a blink in the eye of the universe, you're actually here and now, and you have a sense of the wonder of the whole thing. You can sort of comprehend it. I think that's quite amazing, really.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I don't want to say you do so many things, because doing is part of, like, time. We'll put that in that space. What I know about you is you're a writer and you've created the Louder Than War website. Thank you by the way, because I love that website.
Thanks.
Author, broadcaster, membranes. Where do you find you make the most difference?
I don't think you can ever measure that in any kind of terms. You just do your thing. I mean, the last few years have been much more active on the green, the eco thing, trying to find solutions. But also because I know a lot of people in that world, you know, it's a friend of mine. He's one of the leading green industrialists in the UK. He does a lot of wind energy here. Mm. And I've just been linking him up with a lot of politicians, like the mayors of Manchester and Liverpool, to try and get a zero carbon model from two cities. Manchester and Liverpool are very progressive cities, you know, they've got regal mayors. They want to make these things work. How do you make it work without sort of making people feel like they're being punished, you know? To us, the victory would be that we can still have virtually the same kind of lifestyles, but we don't wreck everything while we have them. It's not. What our thinking is, and our little core of this is, we don't have to live like a monk to save the planet, you know. So my mate, this green industrialist, he's come up with a zero carbon plane. So he reckons within 5 years, like Europe will bring short haul flights with a zero carbon. So it's not about banning people from flying, it's finding an alternative to the pollution of planes. You know, it's not easy. No one's claiming this is an overnight thing, and every solution creates another problem. But at least it's positive, you know, he's going out there looking for solutions instead of sitting there going, it doesn't exist, or everything's, we're all going to die or something, you know, at least it's going down with a fight, at least, at the very, very worst, you know, and the very best, it may actually provide a solution. And there are loads of solutions out there, and it is plausible and it is feasible. It's bumpy, but it's doable, you know. And you can think, maybe music, because it's creative, if you're a creative person, you're attracted to doing it. And you spend all day with sort of creative mindset, which is, you know, either coming up with music or writing about it, and coming up with solutions to problems isn't really another massive jump over. So we've come up with a green education scheme to train people in green jobs. Mm. And we built a green computer game as well. That's all getting launched this year. And it's just doing our bit, really. I mean, I can't save the world, but I can do my own little bit from my own little corner. And over the years, as a musician, you get to know a lot of people. I think the interesting thing about musicians, some musicians, is you know lots of people in different parts of society. You know, people used to go to your gigs, end up being MPs or something. It's kind of weird, you know. And you stay in touch with them, and then, you know, get to know loads of other people. And you think, why don't you speak to that person? You know, and I do a lot of that, you know, because I can't create wind power. It's not what I do. But I know somebody does, and I know somebody needs it, so I get them to speak to each other. That's probably my role in it at the moment and things. So I think we all have a certain responsibility to this. If I can use what I've got to make a difference, and positive as well, I think it's important to have positive thinking. I don't think you get a revolution by being negative. Well, you can have negative revolutions, but they never come out that well, do they? You know, if you can make people's lives better and solve all the problems, that'd be a winner, wouldn't it? You know, so if you can get like green industries and pay people properly instead of like fucking Amazon robbing all the money and not paying any tax. We don't have a better system than that, please. You know, stuff like that, really. I mean, probably people in America go, that sounds like communism. I say it's more like humanism. Why don't we just share stuff? I don't fuck everything up. The planet doesn't need trillionaires. What's the point of them? They don't have any point, do they? They just collect all the money, you know, share it out, you know. It's not going to hurt you that much living in a house of 10 bedrooms instead of living in 100 houses with 100 bedrooms, which you never go in. Yeah. Just, you don't need all that stuff. Like we said before, you're only here for a blink of an eye. You know, you can still have a pretty good time without... I don't know, it's just a weird insecurity, isn't it? Just collecting loads and loads of money in private jets and stuff. It's an insanity, isn't it? You know, and also trying to explain that to people in a way without alienating them. So often you have to listen to people you don't agree with. I think that's really important. I think the problem now is people just shout at each other in really loud voices, you know, and they don't really listen to the other side, which is never going to solve anything, is it, at all?
Yeah, respectful discourse.
Yeah, that's important. You know? And that's kind of what we do here, you know, like my mate, he goes on right-wing TV channels to explain green policies to people who don't really get what you're saying, but inch by inch, they start to think, oh, you're actually talking consensus, guy, you know. So instead of just going in one little circle, you know, and just the people that agree with you already. But it's one good thing about touring, you actually have a little map in your head of most of the Western world. Every city in America, if you go in the downtown, there's always two, three really good vegan cafes. You know, I'm talking about really small places, you know. New York's great, obviously. Even LA, you know, LA's got good options. Just they're not near each other, are they? They're all about 6 miles apart there. But I mean, if you go to Berlin, that's insane there. It's got loads. But it's good, you know, and it's definitely been a revolution in that kind of sphere, hasn't it? And I know it's sort of slowed down the last year, but it was never going to be the same curve all the time. It's always going to speed up and slow down. It's sort of gone slightly out of fashion, hasn't it? But it'll go beyond fashion in the end, you know, because it's a really good idea and it's easy to do. It's not that hard. It's not a chore. It shouldn't be presented as a chore or, you know, or a righteous thing or you're better because you do it. For most people, it's like, well, it just tastes the same. I'll have that. You know, that's all it has to be. My mate actually runs a football club. It's a professional football club and the fourth called Forest Green Road, which is the world's only vegan football club. He bought them out, you know, the club. And he said, you can't sell burgers and meat in them because I'm vegan. That just doesn't make any sense. And all the fans go, oh my God, we can't have that sawdust. It tastes terrible. So he made the burgers taste better. And all the fans started eating and going, oh God, these are really good. These are better than the meat ones. And that is what we call green populism. Populism itself is actually all right. You know, making ideas popular. The only problem is it's the right to do it all the time, isn't it? So why can't we use those tactics for interesting ideas, you know? Then I started thinking that it doesn't matter who's in control. We just get on with it anyway. I mean, it's obviously better if somebody's in control doesn't fuck up and up. But if they're not doing the things that you want to get done, you just do them anyway. People didn't start punk rock bands to get hit records. They started punk rock bands to create their own culture, you know, because that culture didn't exist in the town you lived in. So you made it up anyway. So we could do that with ideas, politics, everything, really. We don't need these people's permission. That was always, you never needed permission to be in a band. You don't need permission to come up with a great idea and make it work. I mean, obviously, it's a lot easier. People give you loads of money to make it work. Most great stuff never came out of those kind of spaces, did it?
Invention and creativity are what really fueled underground.
Yeah, I think all the best stuff happened despite the powers that be, didn't it? Not because of it.
And if anything, there's some good material out there because of the politics. At least here, I guess I'm under the impression that punk started in the UK because of the economic system.
Kind of, yeah, but it's a bit more blurred than that. I mean, the country was a bit decayed, but it wasn't like people went out and bought a Sex Pistols record because the country was decayed. I mean, a lot of people bought a Sex Pistols records in middle class kids were getting good education, students as well. You know, it's a bit more of a mixture than that. And the Pistols' anger may be rooted in the economics they grew up with, you know, but it wasn't anything they directly attribute, you know, they didn't directly sing about it. They caught a feeling, but they were also, they were a great pop band, you know, there's all those levels as well. And I think a lot of the narrative gets added to as it goes along. So it's, in the end, I think in the UK, what it's actually really about is that point in time when you're a teenager and you have no concerns and that feeling of freedom, you know, that thing you could do anything you want, be anybody you want, is that kind of anarchy. And that's probably why it works more. It's more of an instinctive feeling than a manifesto, even though the lyrics are brilliant, you know, but it's, that's probably the true anarchy in pop culture, you know, that it's fleeting. It's only a few weeks where you think, whoa, this is amazing. I can live on whole life dancing around to this song, and then reality kicks in, doesn't it?
Well, I dance around for several decades to some of the same songs.
But then you get responsibilities, and that's, which of course you should have that, but it's that moment of time when it's all that really matters is that song and nothing else matters at all. You're going to live forever because when you're 19, you don't die, you live forever. You know, that way that life feels like that, doesn't it? It feels eternal. It feels completely free, completely wild. And then as years go by, each little bit gets chipped away, doesn't it? You know, you can resist it as possible. But people start dying on you, don't they? And you think, oh, wait a minute, it's not eternal, is it?
But you can fight it every step of the way.
Oh, yeah, you don't give up. But you do realise that that beautiful naivety of youth is a fleeting moment. To me, that's the true meaning of great music. It soundtracks that moment of insane freedom, that kind of music anyway.
Yeah, but those moments are so precious, and even if they are fleeting, they're there.
Oh, no, it's brilliant. It should be celebrated. Those tracks celebrate it in the first place. And it's always with you, isn't it, that moment?
Yeah.
Somewhere lurking around, you know, that. And you could conjure it back up again by listening to a great piece of music or just getting the mood, or it's there, isn't it? It's what you're always striving for. You know it exists, which I think is important as well.
you know, you had those moments. So tell me about a moment like that for you.
Well, they're all musical ones. I think, you know, there will be like from the music you listen to when you're young, but also when you're playing gigs, you get that feeling as well. Or ideas, you know, like just brilliant ideas, interesting ideas that just spark another idea that created that creative rush, you know, where time stands still and you get the avalanche of ideas and it seems unstoppable. So that's always the thing, isn't it? You know, you go, oh, that's brilliant. I'll just have a cup of tea and come back to this. So you get a cup of tea and you completely forgot what the move was. When you're in the zone, just stay in the zone. Don't fuck with the zone.
Well, the zone will give you the energy to stay with it.
Oh, completely, yeah. But you get distracted, don't you? You go, like I say, you go, I'll just get a cup of tea and keep going on this. It's great. And then you go back and think, and it's so subtle, a shift. You think, oh, God, where was that? But always celebrate ideas, isn't it? That's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, so I'm looking forward to seeing you in New York. A couple things I just do really want to acknowledge and thank you for was during lockdown when Dave Greenfield passed, I saw your YouTube video. So the Stranglers for me were like the band. They're the first band that I got into in 77. And I already had tickets to come and see them. I've seen them as many times as I could in the US, but I was going to that tour also. And it was just such a weird time in terms of we couldn't communicate with each other. Like, I mean, you could,
yeah,
you know, specific Zoom calls. And I was doing some interviews. It was just weird. And your video, and it really wasn't very long, but you just picked out certain songs that Dave really shined at. And Stranglers fans really know that so much. And that was just perfect and perfectly timed.
Musically, I would say they were the best band of that period. I mean, they were such misfits, which we really liked as well. In the north, I mean, obviously the Pistols started it, and I love the Pistols. You can't get around that. You know, without the Pistols, none of this would have happened. But the Stranglers kind of, because they were so awkward and also genuinely dark and malevolent, they weren't making it up. They were, they were kind of strange, awkward people. Made it even more attractive. And in the north of England, they definitely made sense. There was a psychedelicness to them which we could chime with as well. And I think nearly all the musicians of my generation, like doing rock and roll bands, rock bands, whatever, were really into them. You know, bands you'd never expect. You know, they're a musicians band, and they were huge as well. They after the Pistols, they were the biggest band of the whole of that new scene. The Clash didn't have proper hit singles in Britain. The Clash used to get to like number 30, and the Stranglers have top 10 singles. The first two albums were in the charts for a year. You know, they were massive. People get all this, don't they? Because they were so, they didn't really get on the music press. They got written out of the story. But they were, for people, you know, people know they were definitely in the story. It's funny because we saw them last autumn. They got the new keyboard player in. And I'm saying to him, he's called Toby. He's really good, isn't he? And I was saying, what's it like? I mean, you do know every single fan in that room knows every note. You can't fluff one note. He said he was pretty nerve-wracking. It's like everyone's going, I hope he's good. But, you know, if he's not good, we're not going to go and see him again. I mean, it's a lot of pressure, isn't it? But he did sound amazing.
And I think that they got him originally just as a stopgap because they had that whole tour booked. I saw three shows on that tour. That was the first time I flew after the pandemic to come to those shows. I saw the two in London and I went to Manchester. And
I went to that. I mean, that's the pressure he's under because people come from all over the world, don't they? They know every single note. So imagine if you got one note wrong, everyone go, oh, fuck, he's fucked it up.
I know. My Airbnb was close to the London venue. So one day I just went and I hung out there and I did get a chance to talk to him, you know, saw him at the stage door and everything. And he really very nice and kind. I was like, we're behind you. You have to do this.
Yeah, he's dead nice. He's probably too nice to be a Stranger, but he's nice.
Well, now, yeah.
No, they're good guys. I mean, we toured them a few times over the years. And there was a few years where I was probably about the only person who would champion them, you know, in writing. A lot of people, they were either written off or just sniffed out. But I think over the years, I managed to change the narrative a bit to get them as appreciated as they should have been. You know, that's not down to me. It's down to them being really good. You know, I'm just trying to recalibrate the story. You can't write about 1977 and miss them out just because they don't fit in directly with the story. You know, there's lots of things that are parallel or don't fit, but are equally as important, you know. And I think, in a way, you could argue that most of post-punk came out of the Stranglers, changing people's thinking quite experimental as well. They did create something that sounded, there's a bit of a Doors vibe there, but not enough. With that bass sound, they created something that's really original and different, and the placements of the musical instruments. You can see it all over post-punk and to a certain extent goth as well. You know, it goes, runs through there, you know. Just ask Peter Hook. Yeah, it's his favourite band, isn't it? You know, he's massively influenced. Or, yeah, or ask The Cure, Simon Gallup, you know, total acolyte as well, Jack Bunnell. Used to play a bit like him, move around like him. It's all in there, you know. You too were massive Stratus fans.
Wow.
They supported him, didn't they, when they were 16?
Oh, I didn't know that. The Stranglers came here a few times, but not that many, and they really hadn't come in a long time, which is why I knew that I was going to fly over for those shows. And
they kind of decided not to bother with America, which I think, in a way, was a shame, really. I think they thought America would make them sound too American or something. I mean, it doesn't necessarily, just because the Clash got Americanized, in a good way, you know, it's not the Clash's Americanization was actually quite interesting. The Stranglers would have taken a different type of America. They already were American, really. A British take on American music. You can hear the Bells, the Doors, the Seeds, all that stuff mixed up in their sound. It's a shame the America mainstream never got to discover the Stranglers. There's some British bands that meant fuck all here, go to America and get massive and go, Jesus, I really like them.
Well, I know. I mean, I was so excited to go to all these shows that were like 5,000 people to see the Stranglers. You know, I mean, I've seen there's been 30 people in the States. I do know that one of their early tours, they did get everything stolen in New York or New Jersey.
Yeah.
Because I remember there were no photos allowed, especially because Dave was playing a whole different set of keyboards. I've tried to interview them every single time they come in, and sometimes I get to and sometimes I don't. But I did get to speak to Hugh on that tour, and he was like, Dave's got all these keyboards they're not his. So we don't want any pictures. He's going to be fumbling around. And he wasn't fumbling around. I mean, Dave is Dave. You know, he's a genius.
Yeah.
So he just went swimmingly. But they were all playing stuff that they were not used to.
Well, that original keyboard he had, was it called a Celembatron? I never get the name right. It was stolen on that tour. And that's when their sound changed. So the Raven, he doesn't have that, you know, that kind of bubbly keyboard sound. Yeah. But years later, their studio engineer does their latter albums. He sampled all the notes, and so they created a techie version of that keyboard sound. So they've got that keyboard sound back now.
Yeah,
because nobody makes those keyboards anymore. They were like, of course, it's like a Slembertron or something. Really rare keyboards, and they could never get it replaced. It took about 30 years till they could sample those keyboard runs, which get triggered off the electronic keyboard Toby has now. That's how they do it now. So they've actually got the sound back with a lot of tech. Yeah.
All right, sir, I'm going to let you go. Now we talked about the Stranglers. Thank you. You make a difference in the history of our music. And the book is great. Thank you for doing what you do.
Yeah, thanks for your time. Yeah.
Well, have a great day. You're sitting there in the sun.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye.
Thanks so much to John Robb for having a talk here. Hopefully some of you will get a chance to go see him. Right now, the dates that I have, he will be in New York in October, around the 12th, 13th, or 14th, in that vicinity. October 18th in LA at CalArts. October 19th in San Francisco at Postmortem. October 20th in LA at Book Soup and at The Monty. And on October 21st at Bar Sinister, also in Los Angeles. Check the show notes for any updated dates. I will put the New York dates on there as soon as I get them. They've been moved around a little bit, but he will be here. And that concludes another episode. Thank you for tuning in. More on the way. My Instagram handle is one word, Diane Kamikaze. Kamikaze ends with an E. Follow me there. The full link to my index of shows can be found on wfmu.org/playlists/DK. So that's playlists plural. And then the DK is both uppercase, capital letters. I am working on encore presentations. I've got years of interviews and podcasts. If there's something
you'd like to see reposted, please get in touch. Send me email, diane@wfmu.org. And be sure to subscribe to the show. And if you like it, review it. Thank you. Diane's Kamikaze Fun Machine radio show can be heard on the WFMU Rock and Soul radio stream. That is New York time, 9 a.m. on Wednesdays. Thank you, thank you. See you next time. Always have fun. Self-expression is vital. Do it.